Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at FreeStyleLibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit MyFreeStyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.
Hi folks, welcome along to another episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. It is lovely to have your company today. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks so much as well for a nice little flurry of emails that have come through. What's really nice as well is when they come through from composers and things like that. We had a really nice response to this absolutely fantastic conversation that we had with the cast and filmmaker for I Swear. We didn't put that out as a kind of a usual podcast episode. We ran a clip of it and it's over on our YouTube channel for you to check out. But what's really nice is we got some emails from people. Adam Lewis got in touch and he said, "Hi Edith, I've just discovered your soundtracking podcast. I think it's Ace, so I drop a little email. Music has been a constant companion since childhood and I've discovered that performing or composing often suppress my tics entirely, a phenomenon shared by many musicians with Tourette's. I'd love to share both personal insights and broader reactions on neurodiversity in the arts, helping audiences understand the creative possibilities of living with a condition like this. I'd be delighted to record an interview or join a live segment and provide short audio samples of my work and our tracks." Adam, thank you so much for getting in touch. So excited that you have found the podcast, and we'd definitely love to get in touch as well with you about at some point finding some time to chat to you. And then Lara as well. Lara says, "Hi, I love that people are, you know, just discovering the podcast as well, even if we are 500 odd episodes in. It doesn't matter when you find us, just so long as you have, really." And Lara says, "Hi Edith, I came across Soundtracking whilst looking for podcasts that dive into the stories and creative journeys behind music. It was such a great discovery. I love how you bring artists' experiences to life through their soundtracks." Lara also says, "What's the best way to submit a guest pitch for your show? Is it through this form?" Lara, yes, it absolutely is. Let us know who you would like to hear, or if you've got a suggestion, someone that you know. We would love to hear from you. Love to hear from all of you. info@edithbowman.com is the email address to get in touch. Right then, our latest guest on Soundtracking, actually, just quickly, before I get to that, I have done the most ridiculous amount of interview records over the last couple of weeks whilst I've been here at London Film Festival. I've got one more to do today and potentially tomorrow, and then I'm just not going to talk for a few weeks, I think. So let me run you down the list of people that we've spoken to. Nia DaCosta, Jodie Foster, Ryan Johnson, the team behind Lurker, Yorgos Lanthimos, Edward Berger, Chloe Zhao, Paul Mescal, Jesse Buckley, the team behind Train Dreams, Guillermo del Toro, Alexander Desplat, Scott Cooper, Jeremy Allen White, Jeremy Strong, Odessa Young for Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, Ronan Day-Lewis for his debut feature film An Enemy, which is so brilliant, and a great score from Bobby Krillick. And then the ones that I've still got to do are History of Sound and Dow, my love. So it's been a busy old time and I've loved the chats, but I can't wait to share the conversations with you. But let's get to today. Our latest guest on Soundtracking is Aziz Ansari, who joined me live in front of an audience at the brand spanking new Everyman Whiteleys. It's so good. And it was for one of our Everyman Soundtracking film clubs, which followed a screening of his film Good Fortune, which he wrote, produced, directed and appears in. Also starring Seth Rogen, Sandra Oh and former guest on Soundtracking, Keanu Reeves. It tells the story of a well-meaning if inept angel who gets involved in the lives of a gig worker and wealthy venture capitalist. I don't know, it's kind of got a kind of Trade in Places vibe to it, but I just found this such a tonic with everything that's going on at the minute. It's ridiculous, it's funny, it's really kind of got a bit of a deep undertone to it as well in terms of state of things in the world and, you know, just thinking about other people outside of our own situation. And yeah, it's a clever little film in that it's got layers. It's scored by another former guest on the show, Carter Burwell. So we'll begin with his cue, Keep Your Dreams Alive. I was just saying, I saw a couple of people leaving and I was like, they're crying. Man, the film really affected. Then I realised they'd been next door watching Downton Abbey. So
that tracks. Yeah. It's very emotional.
Yeah, totally. Listen, congratulations on this film.
Oh, thank you.
It's a little cheeky thing because on surface level, it's one thing in terms of it really makes you laugh. It's really funny. But there's actually a lot going on there. There's a lot to kind of unpack and there's a lot to kind of consider as well, I think, in terms of what you're saying in this film. What was the starting point? What kind of was the catalyst to, first of all, writing this or coming up with this idea for these characters and what the story would be?
I'd been doing stuff that was a little more dramatic and I really wanted to do a comedy. And I'd been spending time in L.A. and I kind of had these two guys in my head and I would always get to like page 40 and I didn't really knew what was going to happen. Like I got to like the credit card where he uses the credit card and he gets fired and I was like, what happens then? And then I was like, what if Keanu's an angel? No, I didn't I didn't go straight there, but I went to this idea of the angel because I'd had this notion of this, an angel kind of putting out this gambit with the guy and the guy being like, no, I don't buy it. And then it kind of went from there.
Did you write it specifically for Keanu though?
No, I originally wrote it thinking that Seth would be the angel, and it's trivia. And Seth and I met with some people. We were trying to find someone to play Jeff, and then I was like, I don't know if I can find anyone that can pull off Jeff the way I want, except Seth, honestly, because I think what Seth does so well is you know, he's that character who's doing some kind of douchey stuff, but he's still kind of fun, and you like him, and you're rooting for him, and he's so funny playing that frustration when he's got to do all this stuff when his life gets swapped, and then we had the angel part open, and someone brought up Keanu, and I was like, what? If that's something that could happen in reality, and I met him here in London. Yeah, he was here. By chance, I stay here a lot. My wife lives here, and so I live here most of the time. And he was here in London, and I went to meet him. He was staying at some hotel, and as soon as I walked in, he was standing there like he is on the poster, with both his arms out, with you know, people taking pictures and like kissing babies and doing his Keanu thing.
With wings and a trench coat.
Yeah. And I was like, oh my God.
This is,
and he had long hair because he was like doing the wig stuff. Yeah. And so it was like very much, whoa, this is very, this seems like it's got to be the guy. And also, I when his name came up, I started reading the script and doing like a Keanu voice in my head and everything just seemed funnier. And once he came on at all, I started just writing more and more for that character. And he's incredible.
He has that kind of ability to like play dumb, but he's not, you know, that kind of thing of like the character sort of in a way. It's like that sort of almost like naivety, that childlike kind of quality and stuff as well.
Yeah.
And it's the physicality of it as well, and the way that
Yeah, it's, there's just all these little nuances about it that are so brilliant in the storytelling.
Yeah, we really dialed it into him. And you know, if you watch some of his, when me and Keanu were talking about what to do with the character, we talked about Parenthood, his character Todd and that, and, yeah. You know, obviously the stuff he did in Bill and Ted. But Todd, who, you know, people may not know as well if you haven't seen Parenthood, which I was rewatching on TV the other day, so good. But yeah, he's so... He has this sweetness to him, and he's so funny when he's playing all this stuff you're just describing. And it just became like such a comedy writer's dream. Like everything, you could just come up with him doing anything, and it would be funny because it's like, okay, this guy's never done anything. So it's like, okay, what if he's using the internet? Oh, he's just going to look up photos of baby elephants. And you just write, it's just so fun.
It's just that scene of him eating a food for the first time.
Oh, yeah, that was so fun. That was like the first big scene we shot, and I was just cracking up. And I remember we were shooting it, and I yelled out to them this one line that's at the end of the scene where I said, okay, Seth, say you're a big boy now, and then Keanu take a bite and go, I'm a big boy now. And then they just did it, and it was like magic. But that was a really fun scene to film. And it was the first scene with the two of them that was a long scene like that, and as soon as we framed it up, I thought, wow, this feels good, seeing these two on screen together.
When you were kind of, you know, sitting down writing the script, first of all, did you have in mind that the script would have this kind of depth to it, that you knew that you wanted it to be a comedy but kind of with substance to it as well? Was that the plan, or did that kind of come out in the writing?
I'd say both. You know, I wanted to make sure if I was writing about some of that stuff, which is, you know, sensitive topic matter, I that I got it right and that I was respectful of what I was writing about. So I did my best to research and get it right and get the details right. And I interviewed a lot of people and talked to a lot of people that were, you know, gig workers or people that had slept in their cars and all these things, and you know, try to do it in a way where I was getting the details right.
Yeah, and these kind of, they're so brilliantly written characters. You know, Kiki's character as well is just, you know, as well, and that whole side of what her character's fighting for as well. And great to see her in this kind of role.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Kiki is incredible because, you know, she's so funny, but also I think she has such the heart of the film as her. And yeah, she was always in the back of my head for that character. And I was really glad that she was able to do it.
How was it directing yourself?
It's a mode I'm very comfortable in because I did it on my Netflix series. Yeah. And I'm very easy to work with. You know, I don't drop out. You know, sometimes actors are like, hey, another thing came up. I never do that to myself. And I take direction for myself very well. I know exactly what I want for myself, and I know how to give it to myself. No, you know, Seth and I talk about this because he does that on his series now in the studio, and it's a little bit of a cheat code. There's a little bit of a streamlining. But there's also something so fun about having people like Seth and Keanu and all the amazing cast I have, and you write something and you have an idea of how you imagine they're going to do it, and then it's like, oh, whoa, they did something a little unexpected, and they pushed it up a notch, and it's super fun.
Is that an important element for you as a director to kind of give them that freedom to play with things then? Like, you know, with like Sandro and Keanu in a skeet scene together, it's like, guys, let's do the script, but then let's play. Or how does it work with you?
Well, I try to do that and try to collaborate with them in advance. So when we're there on the day, you know, anytime you're on set with the cameras, that time is so precious. Mm-hmm. So I try to do as much as I can beforehand. So, you know, the scene where Keanu and Seth are outside the Korean restaurant, and, you know, Keanu's character started smoking. I remember we were at my house rehearsing that. And I think I pitched Keanu that joke where it's like, when you start smoking cigarettes, and Seth, you're like, what are you doing? And then you go, leave me alone, Jeff, it's all I have. And it cracked me up when we did it in my house. And I was like, I think that's going to work. And I think it did. And it still made me laugh now when I said it. And Keanu, he smokes, and so I'd see him smoke, and he looks so cool. Keanu just does you just don't understand how cool Keanu is. This is Keanu. Hey, Keanu, can you come for rehearsal? Sure. At your house? Yeah. He shows up, and he shows up on a motorcycle that looks like it's like he drove out of an anime movie. And then he gets out, he's got like a futuristic backpack, boots, and he's like, oh, shoes off? And I'm like, if you don't mind, but I mean, I don't know. And he's like, got like 30 laces. He's like, not a problem. And then he's just the cool is. I remember when we first were trying to get Keanu to do this, like, he was like, he read the script, he's like, I like it, and he's like, you know, I have some other things going on. He was touring with his band and stuff. And we're like, well, you know, what if you do a table read with us? He's like, come to my house, we'll just read, me, you, and Seth, we'll have a couple people, and we'll just read together. And he was like, okay. And then we were like, do you want to get some, should we, we're, amongst my team, we were like, should we order some food? And should we get, you know, should we get food beforehand or after? And it was like, whoa, we got to get this right. Because it's like, okay, if you get food before, then everyone's full. And then they're like reading, and they're like, oh, I'm a little tired. But if you go after, then everyone's reading the whole time. They're like, when's this thing gonna end? I'm getting hungry. So what do you do? I eventually said, okay, let's, first I picked this burrito place called Sonora Town, which is amazing in LA. We were in LA. And it's and I was like, well, we can't get Sonora Town before. Let's get Sonora Town afterwards to get some burritos. And I scheduled the read, so it was like, okay, it ended at a time when everyone get hungry. It would like end at like 7:30. And we ordered the Mexican food, and I remember like everyone put their order, and Keanu got some guacamole on the side of his thing, and there was like a guacamole container that just said Keanu, and I saved the top and framed it. And I have it in my house, and it's a Keanu guacamole top. I don't think I've told him that story. Yeah.
Just frozen the leftover guacamole.
The guacamole was cleaned off. It's washed. The guacamole was finished.
Glad to hear that. You were talking about kind of researching the kind of authenticity to some of those kind of situations and characters. What about ghost movies? You know, in terms of like contemporary, not in that respect.
What do you mean, angel movies?
Angel movies. Angel movies.
Ghost movies is different
ghost
project.
Ghost movies are different, yeah. Angel movies.
You know the difference between ghosts and angels, right?
I think so, yeah. I thought that was your sequel.
It's wildly different.
The sequel.
No. Yeah. Angel movies, yeah. I mean, I watch probably 100 movies because, you know, we started shooting and then we had to stop because of the writer's strike. And so we had a few months off and I didn't work on the script because you're not supposed to, and I also welcomed it because that space, whatever you're working on script, if you have that space for some, you know, if it's a couple weeks, whatever, it's nice to have a, you know, to look at it with fresh eyes.
Yeah.
But I watched so many movies, but I watched every Angel movie, I think. But, you know, I love Wings of Desire, It's a Wonderful Life, A Matter of Life and Death, mm-hmm. Paul Pressburger, UK Zone. What other angel? Heaven Can Wait. There are so many great ones, and you know, the idea of doing one now and putting this kind of modern spin on everything, and having it be Keanu, seems very fun.
What about music in terms of, you know, Carter Burwell doing your score on this as well? I mean, that's the big guns. That's, you know, Martin McDonagh and Conan Brothers there, right there. He's an amazing composer.
Yes.
Why him?
He did. You know, one of the movies I watched. You know, when you think about, like, there's a body swap element, and if you think about, what's the best body swap movies, I have an answer that you might not expect, and I think it's Being John Malkovich, which you don't think of as a body swap, but it kind of is, you know, kind of in the way this is, where it's like, you know, it's another guy getting a glimpse into this, a guy that's dissatisfied with his life getting a glimpse into a life that seems more glamorous, and Carter did the score for that, as well as Adaptation. Spike Jonze, Charlie Kaufman, that era, I mean, those are like my favorite films. I constantly rewatch them, but I watch Being John Malkovich a lot. Just, I think, one of the greatest screenplays, one of my favorite movies ever. And Carter did the score for that, and Spike is a good friend of mine, and I asked him about Carter, and I said, you know, I never done score before. I've, you know, mastered on the series I did. We used just source music, which means just, you know, picking songs. So I asked him, I was like, what do you think about Carter? And he said, you know, when I did that, I hadn't worked with anyone that did score. And if I was you and I was going on that journey, Carter would be my first call. And he'll be a great person to help you. And he was. And it was one of those things where we're like, oh, you know, I said, what about Carter Burwell? And everyone's like, oh, yeah, sure, Aziz. Like, it worked out. And he was great, and we recorded the score in London here at Abbey Road, which was also one of the coolest things to do that
picture?
With Carter, huh?
Did you do the crossing picture?
What do you mean?
Come on,
the crossing.
Yeah.
Hold on, you didn't know what ghosts were earlier, so let's just calm down. That I didn't understand your accent when you said the crossing picture.
Sorry, I forgot the subtitles.
No, I didn't do it, but I do know what you mean. But I didn't do it.
What was it like? recording in Abbey Road, though, because it's a magical place. The history in that place is extraordinary.
The coolest thing is, you know, there's a cafeteria there, and you go down there and you eat that. You're like, that's the coolest thing. Let me finish. Don't worry.
Paul McCartney's serving muffins.
Yeah, close. But there's pictures of the Beatles like eating in the same cafeteria, and it's just such a funny thing to see. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I'm a Beatles fan and love all the folklore, and to be there was very cool.
With Carter, though, was it just a case of, did he respond to the script, and did you kind of talk to him about, you know, those films that were, you know, were inspiring in a way for you, or influential in a way, and his work within those?
Well, I knew that he could do score for the kind of comedy I want to do, which was something that was, you know, had this fantastical element, but was grounded and, you know, was able to give pace when I needed it and do all the stuff tonally that those films he worked on with Spike did. Yeah, I sent him the script and he liked the script and then he was on.
Did you know what you wanted? Did you have an idea of kind of, yeah, well, Carter Burwell, but what you wanted him to do?
Well, when you're editing a movie, what you do is you put in temp score, which is, you know, you use score from other films or, you know, classical music pieces and or instrumental pieces, whatever you want. And so, you know, from those what's in their temp, you get kind of an idea of tonally what the director's going for. And every composer has a different process. Some people like to watch the movie with nothing and just kind of feel it. Other people want to see what you've chosen for temp. I think Carter was the latter. But that was kind of a little direction. And then the process, I'd never done it before. It was very interesting. He would send sketches, and those would be his kind of rough versions of the score that he'd composed on MIDI. And I think that's the right terminology, but anyway, he would send that, and we would try those, and we'd give feedback, oh, you know what, I feel like it needs a little more energy, or, you know, oh, something a little more emotional, whatever, and I would try to do my best, and he would keep sending stuff, and we'd go back and forth, and then you'd land on something like, ooh, I like this. But what was interesting is, like, he sent me this thing that was, like, the main theme, and once he had that main theme, it was kind of off to the races, and he would just do variations of that. And it would just find its way into the movie, and it was really cool to see how he extrapolated it into all these different pieces of score.
Brilliant needle drops in the film as well.
Oh, thank you.
Were those written into the script, or were those, did you kind of find those along that journey as well? Or
some of those are written into the script. I work with this gentleman, Zach Cowie, who worked with me on Master of None.
Yeah.
And he and I worked together a lot on the music, and it was really fun. And it's a little bit of a challenge because sometimes you find a song, but, you know, you have to work within a certain budget, and you know, you have to...
Songs are expensive, man.
They are, yeah. But we were really fortunate that we were able to get all these songs. And, you know, I love all the songs we got. And I was messaging him this morning, actually, because we were doing another screen tomorrow, and I was making, like, a little playlist to play for... I think I made it for this, too. I don't know if they played it, but it was, like, kind of music from the movie and some other stuff that we didn't use that we liked. And I was like, man, these are great, great songs. And we had, like, a fun soundtrack, I think. So I'm really happy with it.
When you're writing those into the script, are you putting those in because you like them, or are you putting them in because you're thinking about how they connect to, I don't know, emotion or where the character is or how the audience are feeling? What's the kind of decision process of the choices that are in there, whether it's, you know, I've made a list of a few of them, but like Salt and Pepper Push It or Beck New Pollution, Inner City Good Life, all those ones. There's so many, there's loads, and there's such
great
choices.
If you give me one, I can tell you the story of each one, because they're
Beck,
all a little
New
different.
Pollution.
New Pollution. So we wanted something that kind of was kind of like an Arge jam. It's kind of setting up who he is, so it needed a little pace. Zach was very much into it being Beck and kind of felt like this guy would listen to Beck, and that, you know, there's a little 90s kind of vibe. And I love New Pollution, and I think it has a really fun pace. And also the other thing is, like, there's a lot of dialogue under that whole sequence, so having something that is fun and has pace but doesn't distract from the dialogue, so you can hear the jokes. But that song has that great drum beat, the bah, 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 bah. And so it kind of gives the whole thing a little pace.
She's got the lily white cat equators. She's got a carburetor tied to the moon. Pink eyes looking to the food of the ages. She's alone in the new pollution. She's alone in the new pollution.
Salt, pepper, shit.
I think we were just trying to find a funny song to have him have the pool party. We had so many different things, and we tried to push it. And something about, if you watch it again, you'll notice that whenever Keanu steps in, that's when the, ooh, baby, baby. And so I was like, that's the universe telling us to do this. Oh, God, sorry. I like, hurt my stomach yesterday.
Oh, wow.
You want to hear the weirdest injury?
Yeah.
I was making some chicken curry at home. And, I is there any Indian people here? No? No, there's a few. There's a few shy ones. But do you ever cook at home? You cook Indian food? Okay, so, like, when you have chicken thighs, do you cut it through the bone, or Yeah, you cut the bone in the middle, right? So you have what are called curry-sized chunks. So I had some poultry shears, and I was cutting the chicken with the I think these shears were, like, not sharp or something, and I was like, and then I just really put all of my might into it, but the back of the shears clipped onto my belly, and it didn't cut, but it's really taken me out. I haven't sat down this long since the injury last night, so anyway.
Wow, chicken shear injury.
Do you have a chart that shows how quickly people drop off when they're listening? Because I feel like the... Then he started talking about...
This is when we drop in the advert
for
either recipes or, like, kitchen utensils at that point, medical insurance.
Well, not that one, because that I got hurt.
But where there's blame, there's a claim. That's what we threw in at that point. What about Inner City? Good luck.
Inner City, so Zach was always into Jeff's house having, like, house music. Yeah. And that he loved the idea of using all this 90s house stuff, which I think is so fun. And there was two Inner City tracks that we really liked. There's Good Life, and then there's Big Fun. And we used Good Life. That felt a little better, but... Yeah, that was it was like, oh, in Jeff's house, we're listening to house music. And when we're in Arj's world, we're listening to, like, kind of 90s stuff. Like, you know, there's a go-between song, The Streets of Your Town, and then there's Beck. And so that was the idea.
Let me take you to a place I know you want to go. It's a good life. Hey, yeah. I don't want to stand around and beg you. Just don't say no. No, no.
And then the Sylvester track's got a pull through from Trading Places.
I mean, there's a little nod to Trading Places. I also just love that song. And I was talking to you backstage about how the edit we made is so, like, when it kicks in, it just starts with that scream where he's like, ah! And it's so, it just gives such a shot of energy. And if you watch, there's, like, live videos of Sylvester performing, and it's kind of incredible to see him do that scream.
Yeah. So The one thing that I really miss from DVDs, when you used to get DVDs and you used to get the second disc, the DVD extras, is like the bloopers.
Oh, the bloopers.
And for me, I imagine there being some really great moments that didn't make the edit of maybe the equivalent of bloopers that would make that disc on the DVD.
I can't remember. I think, you know, sometimes what we do now is when we have the rap party, you play some bloopers and stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like we made some, but yeah, I mean, we were laughing a lot, you know, especially, you know, when someone would improvise something. Seth would usually get me, and Keanu would get me sometimes. But yeah, we definitely had fun.
What's Seth like to direct?
He's great because he's, you know, people think he's like, oh, the guy's stoned all the time. He is such...
Come on.
He's so sharp. He's so smart. And he's made so many movies. He understands movies. And he's such a great collaborator. And, you know, I showed him the script early on. And he would, you know, every couple of months we'd meet up and maybe talk and read it. And he'd see where the draft was. And he'd always have little tips. And he really understands the mechanics of screenwriting and what makes movies work. And, you know, we were trying to do some work on the ending, and I remember him telling me, like, you know, the thing to keep in mind is, what is this guy doing at the end of the movie that he wouldn't have done at the beginning? And that's actually something I think about all the time. I don't, in screenwriting, it's really that simple sometimes. My friend Alan and I, who's a producer on it, we always talk about the French toast moment, which is referencing Kramer versus Kramer, where in the beginning of the movie, he can't make French toast. So then at the end, he can make French toast. And you see it even, like, this weekend I saw it. One battle after another. Close your ears if you didn't see it, or pause your podcast. But I feel like at this point, I feel like if you haven't gone, I'm kind of ready to fuck you over because it's got really good reviews, and you should have gone by now. No, that's not nice. Maybe it's been sold out. But
go on.
In one battle after another, in the beginning of the movie, he doesn't have a phone. He's, like, worried about his daughter. At the end, she's like, I'm going here, Dad. And he's like, okay. And he just takes a selfie. And, you know, that's the movie, right? That's how the guy changed. That's literally the end of the movie. And it's like, oh, okay, that's the journey the guy went on in the movie. And you know, in this movie, it's like, okay, in the beginning of the movie, he's, like, lying to his dad and everything. And in the end, he's honest with his dad.
It's so interesting hearing you talk about filmmaking, because just the references that you make and clearly how much you love film. Really, really evident. You know, Powell and Pressburger, all the kind of references and things that you're dropping into conversation. You're clearly a big film fan.
Yeah, I mean, I realized when I started thinking about really focusing on directing, I realized that, okay, look at the greatest directors of the lot, PTA, Scorsese, Tarantino, what do they all have in common? They've seen every movie. They're walking encyclopedias. And I thought to myself, that cannot be a coincidence. Mm-hmm. So I just started really being aggressive about trying to watch all these movies. And you know, I know you do these kind of things, and there's someone sitting in the audience like, I haven't seen anything. I was that guy, I promise you. And you can watch a movie a day and you know, whatever. You can rack them up very quickly, and you can go through those lists very quickly. And you know, there's so many resources, you know, whether Letterboxd or whatever, or just your friends. I'm a big advocate of trying to turn to people to ask. But
yeah,
I was watching
totally.
A movie. You know, what's funny is I'm doing all these interviews for this, and like I'm like finishing up another thing, and I've been watching movies for that. And I was rewatching this movie that I hadn't seen in a while this morning, and I was just so blown away by it. Seconds by John Frankenheimer. Just truly incredible. Has anybody seen Seconds?
I'm gonna write that down. Like that.
Nobody.
A recommendation.
Nobody. Just me in this whole place.
But that's good. That's like 100 people gonna go watch it now.
You should definitely watch it. So the premise of the movie is.
Don't give it away.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Hey, I thought I could do it in a non-spoiler way, but no, it's truly incredible. It might be cool to just see it going in cold, but there's a cinematographer named James Wong Howe, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but. I think one of the most incredible cinematographers. He shot that movie HUD as well, Paul Newman film. But he shot the movie, and you watch this movie, and it's very old, but it looks like, you know, something Wong Kar-wai in terms of how wild the camera work is and the lenses and things. It's so ahead of its time, and you're stunned. And the movie's very dark and interesting, and yeah.
Is there a point, though, when you started delving into movies like that you realized how important music can be in that storytelling element and the effect a film can have? Or are there soundtracks that really stand out to you as being memorable?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course. I mean, there's so many great ones of, you know, I remember being in college and all the Wes Anderson soundtracks that were always incredible, and you know, all the Tarantino soundtracks. And both of those guys in particular, amazing needle drops, but stuff that's a little bit deeper that you haven't heard sometimes and always fit very perfectly. But that was something I have to give credit to Zach Cowie. He really kind of showed me how to work all that, you know? Like, even at the end, right, in the end of this movie, that Send Me an Angel song, I was like, I don't know. And he was like, what do you want people thinking about? And I was like, I guess Keanu and the angel. And he was like, then do Send Me an Angel. And I was like, okay. And I think he's right. He's very sharp about putting a lot of thought into what you're using, because it's not just like using a cool song.
Yeah.
You know, there's stuff I did in like season one of Master of None where I realized, oh, there wasn't the level of thought I put into the stuff in season two. And I think that was a little bit of Zach being more confident and kind of pushing me and me kind of understanding, like putting that extra layer of thought into what, being so intentional with what these songs are. Because you can always put just songs that are cool.
Yeah.
But really being intentional with like, well, what does this say about the character and the lyrics and all these things?
And it's also building your team. You know, as you make this journey and direct and more, it's kind of having those kind of people around you, that the trust there, the collaboration's there, that you can kind of push each other and kind of, you know, experiment with things as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, I mean, making a film is a, any film gets made is a miracle. And the people that are able to make a lot of them, you notice they tend to have the same team over and over because you have that shorthand and you can get things done faster. And you know, in this film, you know, Kelsey Como, one of the co-producers, she's been with me for a long time. Actually, it was our 7 years of working together anniversary today, she told me. Yes. My brother, Anise, worked on with Master of None, was a writer on Master of None, producer on this. My friend Alan Yang, who co-created Master of None with me, he worked with me on this. He was a producer. So I try to keep those guys around and you know, the people that were new. Kaylee, she was a recommendation for my production designer on Master of None, and we got along very quickly. April, our costume designer. You know, you also have to become very good at kind of doing the interview process and kind of sussing out who really is your vibe and who really understands your references. And you know, when you talk about why do you put the music cues in the script, I realized the more you can do in the script to just convey to people what you're trying to do, like the vibe, and the more specific you can be, because you have it in your head, but you can't assume anyone's got any of the stuff you have in your head unless it's on the page. And ultimately, that's your job as a director, is to kind of tell people what you're trying to do.
Yeah. What can you tell us about the next project, or nothing?
I had two things written. I don't know which one I'm going to do first, but one of them, the one that I was talking about, that seconds, that was that's a sci-fi idea. That's all I'm saying right now.
Oh. I like the sound of that.
I hope I get to make it. I mean, it's obviously everyone talks about how it's such a interesting time for making movies, and everybody, you know, friends of mine that are directors for a long time are like, it's a particularly tough time, and you know, with theatrical and everything. But God, that's why I feel so lucky that we were able to make this movie, and that people are going to get to see it in theaters. And I'm glad you guys saw it in a theater. And I hope anyone listening, that they have an idea of how much more fun it is to see this with a crowd.
Yeah.
You know, and I've seen it, you know, when we did it in Toronto at the film festival, it was like 1,300 people. And when we were screening it in LA for the first times, like the rough cuts, it was like 300 people. And just that, I remember when I went and saw, I don't know if you guys have ever had this experience, but I remember I saw 40-Year-Old Virgin when it first came out.
Amazing.
And it was pandemonium. You know, people left and they were like, holy shit. And I had one friend, I kept telling him, like, dude, you gotta see this. And he was like, oh, okay, yeah. I was like, it's so funny. It's like one of the funniest movies. And we saw it like maybe like 7 weeks after it came out.
Yeah.
And we saw it in a theater where there was like 10 people there.
That never happens. Stuff doesn't stay in the cinema any longer for 7 weeks.
Yeah.
That's another thing that needs to change.
Well,
Films need to be in the cinema for longer.
That I totally agree, because it's sometimes people are busy and you just, you know, it's life. And sometimes it takes a few weeks to get around to seeing it. But yeah, I wish it was a longer window. I don't know what the window will be in good fortune, but hopefully it's long. But
sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. And so I saw the 40-Year-Old Virgin with 13 people, And it just didn't play as well because there just wasn't the crowd. And there were so many things that got huge laughs that didn't get anything from that little crowd. And he left and he was like, yeah, it was good. And it was just nothing like the experience. Like, you know, I also do stand-up. And it's like, yeah, if you go to like the Hammersmith Apollo or Royal Albert Hall, it's a great time. And everyone has a great time. But if there was only like 10 people there, it's not going to work. And if you just heard me do stand-up in your house and no one was laughing, that would... That wouldn't be as good. And there's something you know, the other people are part of the experience. I hope that people have that with this movie and you know, we can get them to go.
We had a good time, didn't we? Yeah? I think we did, yeah.
Cool. I didn't peek in, so you guys could have been quiet the whole time and I'd be none the wiser. I mean, like, why is he still here? None of us enjoyed the film. I wouldn't know, because I just showed up just, send me an angel. All right, I'm here. That was
Thank you for being here. It's been really lovely chatting to you about
thanks
your film.
So much.
And huge congratulations, Aziz, everybody.
Thank you guys so much for coming out.
Thank you.
From the score to good fortune that we can get my watches, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with Aziz Ansari. A huge thanks to Aziz for joining us at Everyman Whiteley's, and for everyone at Everyman for making us feel so welcome and helping us continue this wonderful partnership with our film club. Good Fortune is on general release in the UK cinemas as of now. Carter Burwell and Keanu Reeves, as I said, have been guests on Soundtrackin', and you can find those episodes if you head to edithbowman.com. Follow us on your socials. We're at Soundtrackin' UK, and please do subscribe to our YouTube channel. We're Soundtrackin' Extra for loads of additional video content. Next up, we've got a couple of episodes to share with you. We're going to be hearing from Derek C. in France, who hasn't been on the podcast for 10 years nearly. He's got a new film called Roofman that is out in cinemas as of today, the 17th of October, and well worth checking out. It stars Channing Tatum and Kirsten Dunst. Peter Dinklage is in there as well. It's this kind of multi-genre film, true story about this guy who would rob McDonald's restaurants. He would make sure the staff were kind of safe, kind of a non-aggressive criminal or thief. And it's just a really fascinating story. So excited to share that chat with Derek with you. And then also the entire gang behind Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere. Scott Cooper, the director, Jeremy Allen White, Jeremy Strong and Odessa Young join me to discuss this absolutely beautiful, beautiful film that is coming out on the 24th of October in cinemas. All that to come, and I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.